lovers, and welcome to the Liberty Mike podcast, broadcasting from an undisclosed location in the heart of Dixie. I am Michael, and I am here with Liberty Larry.
How's it going?
Doing okay. How are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Nice weather.
Yeah, it is. It was supposed to rain all day.
Yeah, it didn't. It only rained half the day.
Yeah, barely even that.
Oh, it rained pretty good this morning.
Oh, did it?
Well, it did here.
Didn't where I was at. Yeah. I mean, it rained, but I wouldn't use the words pretty good.
It did also get hotter than it was supposed to get all day.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hotter when I came home than it was supposed to have gotten all day. And that was late afternoon, you know.
Yeah. They can't predict it, man. They don't know what's going on.
Yep. But never mind. I'm not
you
go there.
You want to go on a whole long journey?
I'm not going to go there.
We can do it. Today's the day.
We'll leave that one alone. Yeah. No. I did want to mention that we forgot to talk about last week the calls from government U.S. government officials for Netanyahu to step down.
Oh, yeah.
That was kind of interesting. My only comment on that really is that, well, once again, it's back around to the Democrat Party is greatly divided on the Israel-Palestine question.
Oh, yeah. It's a problem for them going into this election. I mean, generally, the Democrats are pretty good at, like, rallying the troops behind them, but this one's going to be tough.
Yeah,
because they're very split on this, and both sides are pretty passionate about their position on it.
Well, it's not like you can go vote for Trump and get your way if you're opposed to the Democrat position on Israel-Palestine. It's the same thing either way. So I don't actually think that it makes a difference.
That it's
like the worst
thing
that happens is that somebody doesn't go to the polls, but I don't think the people you're talking about mostly in that situation are young people who it's kind
generally
of
generally don't that's baked in.
Yeah, it's a coin flip whether they'll go to the polls or not anyway.
Yeah, there's probably some truth to that.
So, the comment that I wanted to make on it actually is that, you know, we can't help but meddle and ask for a regime change even among our allies.
Yeah, no, there's definitely something to that.
We're not getting our way exactly, ally. You should elect somebody else. We can help.
Yeah, right.
Or something. I don't know. It was just that stood out to
me. It is strange. Especially, I mean, I figure a lot of that's got to be orchestrated. I'm sure he didn't just make the decision to go up there and do that speech. I'm sure he was in contact with the Biden administration and that
sort
of thing.
Yeah, and probably some polling groups that they're like, well, this will play well with the base.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something. Yeah. Well, you know, we're not calling for them to stop their genocide exactly, but we're at least asking for somebody who's less unlikable to be in charge.
Right.
I don't know.
They're definitely walking the tightrope on that right now.
Yeah. Putin was reelected.
Yeah.
He got something like 87% of the vote, which immediately makes everybody in the West say, oh, it's all rigged and blah, blah, blah.
I heard one of the, what was it? One of the stations I listened to, they said he gave himself 87% of the vote. It was like just like assuming that it was rigged.
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb here and call it independent polling inside of Russia. And when I say independent, I mean National Endowment for Democracy funded organization doing polling in Russia, which makes it far from being independent. It's a U.S. government sponsored polling group in Russia, did a poll and came up with something like 86% approval for Putin going into this election.
Yeah.
And then he got 87% of the vote. So it seems to be in line with his approval.
Yeah, it looks like it kind of adds up, right?
It's incredible how hard people have worked in the West to convince everyone that this guy is despised and is only there because he's a complete authoritarian. He's wildly popular in Russia.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is what it is. Like.
Yeah, he just is. He's wildly popular in Russia. He's done. He is. They see him as a savior in a lot of ways, I think. He came in and stamped out a lot of the really terrible corruption that was happening after the fall of the Soviet Union. He has built Russia back up into a world power. From the depths after the fall of the Soviet Union. That place was a complete disaster for like a decade. And, I mean, he's been, on the whole, very good for the Russian people, and they recognize it.
It's kind of a shame to me because, like, I'm not, like, a huge Putin fan. But
this is not to say that he's a good person. No. I know that that's immediately what people are, oh, you're just praising Putin. Well, no.
But it does seem to me, particularly, like, after 9/11, there have been opportunities where the West really could have brought him into the fold. And we could be living in a different planet right now. If even just like a little bit, like cut him a little bit of slack. But like we've had no interest in doing that from the word go.
Yeah, he was absolutely prepared to be friends with the West.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm not saying that that's a perfect world because like, I don't want countries getting along too good. Like, I don't want, like, New World Order stuff, like, one world government. But, like, I do want peace. You know? Like,
well, that's where you're at odds with the ruling elite.
Well, wanting peace? No, 100% agree.
You know, war makes a lot of people a lot of money. Now, it's not better for all of us. Like, of course... You know,
it's not better if your kid's the one going to war.
Well, that's true too, but it's also it sucks a bunch of capital out of the system that could go into something far more beneficial and useful.
Well, absolutely.
This is the Bastiat seen and unseen. That's the unseen. Like all that money that gets sucked out of our economy to go blow stuff up halfway around the world is money that could have been used to provide more consumer goods or build more housing. Or
fill some of those potholes,
or do research.
You
know, medical research, etc. I mean, this is all money that could have gone somewhere else. Where it could have been more productive. But you know, if you're a contractor, it's a circular system. If you're a military contractor, you lobby the government for money, they take it from the taxpayer, they give it to you, you use part of that money to lobby the government for more money. And of course the people that are in government, they benefit from that lobby money. So nice dinners and gifts and who knows what else, other kind of bribes are going on under the table. But anyway, so we get another 6 years of Putin screaming. I mean, screaming about Putin, not Putin screaming. I've actually never seen Putin scream about anything, really.
He seems like the type he doesn't really have to do all that to get his point across.
Just like, tends to be cool and collected, so. But, you know, this is where we are, I suppose. It also benefits... The problem over the last... so I recommend people read The Pentagon's New Map. Because it talks about the military-industrial complex quest for a near-peer competitor. Because after the fall of the Soviet Union, we had the unipolar moment where the U.S. was far and away the most powerful country, and there weren't any real rivals at all. Eventually, China rose, and then Russia again. But the military-industrial complex, they were looking, well, we have to keep these wars going, so that's why we were fighting in the Middle East. Problem is, that doesn't really earn a lot of money.
Not getting it's a lot of big small ticket arms, items.
Like little things. The insurgent wars aren't that great for the military-industrial complex. They, you know, they pay the bills. But it's nothing like buying, you know, fleets of submarines or carriers or, you know, all the top-tier jets to fight a near-peer competitor. You know, the F-22 is kind of wasted in Afghanistan against a country that doesn't have an air force. But it's not wasted against a Russia or a China that has a modern air force. Some would argue with that, but whatever. It's certainly at least more justifiable.
Right.
And so there's been this quest to find the near peer competitor. Like, you don't actually want anybody to become a peer competitor, but if you can create an antagonism with a near peer, then you can get more funding for bigger items.
Yeah.
You know, preparing to fight a war in the Pacific with China is a whole lot different than fighting in the mountains of Afghanistan or in the deserts of Syria.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Yeah.
I guess that's all I have about that. Let's let's get into our actual topics.
All right, yeah, because I was going to say we didn't plan to talk about any of that.
No. No notes on the list for that one.
No.
Okay, so first I wanted to talk, because I find this case particularly interesting, because I don't know what the right answer is on this. Like, I'm not sure. I'm really torn about this case, which is the Crumbly case. Which is just kind of a funny name to me. But the background is that the son, who was 15 at the time, Ethan Crumbly, killed four at the end of November 2021 at Oxford High School in Michigan, outside of Detroit. He was charged as an adult in these murders and sentenced to life plus. But in the last, like, month, maybe 6 weeks at this point, but anyway... Very recently,
yeah.
Both in separate trials, both of his parents have been independently convicted of involuntary manslaughter. And so when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, this is just that next step of trying to find somebody else to blame.
Yeah, we need a scapegoat.
Yeah, we tried to go after the gun companies, the gun manufacturers for these kind of things, and that didn't work. Well, maybe we'll go after the parents now.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll have an impact. but, and so I was against it. And my first thought was, okay, if this kid was tried as an adult and convicted of murder as an adult, then the legal system in America said that he was making his own decisions.
Yeah.
Independently as an adult. And how can we possibly hold his parents accountable for his actions if he's been considered to be making his own decisions freely as an adult?
Yeah. You can't. It feels like, to me, you can't have it both ways.
Right. So that was my thought, too. Then I started reading into the details of this.
Yeah.
And I think I've flipped here. I think that the parents may actually... have some liability in this.
Yeah.
Because there was a whole lot of stuff that was just kind of ignored by them. They seemed to be kind of absentee, first off.
Yeah.
Didn't really know what was going on with the kid. They bought him the gun that he used.
Yeah.
9mm. Took him out to the range a few days before.
Showed him how to use it.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it sounds like they're people that, like, that wasn't their first time at the range is what it sounds like. So he probably already knew how to use it, but yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Now that in and of itself, I don't have an issue with, because I grew up in a house with guns everywhere that were like loaded and ready to go.
Yeah.
My brother and I were taught very young how to handle guns, how to be safe with them, and to respect them.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any issues. And
Well, and I think overall, most families are kind of the same way. Not all, but like overall, like most kids, if they grow up around guns, they're used to handling them. The guns can be around and in the house, and it's not going to cause any problems. But...
This is also outside of Detroit. This is a very different culture than the South.
Exactly. Well, there's that too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm torn on this one because I'm a big believer in keeping your guns put up, keeping them away from the kids. Now, I want my kids to know how to use them. Like, I've shown, like, my kids have went to the range. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they know how to handle a firearm. And then, like you were saying, they know how to respect one.
Yeah.
But... It's still it. The idea that that somebody that's a minor could have unfettered access to a weapon like that, I think is dangerous.
Well, the gun was in a case, not in his room or whatever. Yeah. There is evidence. It wasn't conclusive, I would say, but there is evidence that the case was not secured, like not locked down or anything.
Yeah.
Or locked, period.
Yeah.
There were some other issues that I think are probably more important to the discussion here, which is like there were several references to mental health issues that he had had recently in these articles. It took me a little bit to actually track down what they were talking about. It was, it kept being referenced in this kind of oblique way, but it turns out that he was having some hallucinations, or seems to have been having some hallucinations, and that he had sent text to his mom about some of these hallucinations, and she was just like, whatever, he's just joking around, or like not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, the kid hadn't had any prior disciplinary problems.
Yeah.
It's not like he'd been a problem child or anything. Yeah. But on the day of the shooting, the parents had been brought into the school to meet with the principal, I guess. Because he had drawn a picture on some math work of him with a gun and bullets and like bloody people, and it had phrases on it like blood everywhere and my life is useless. Now, I drew some like pretty gnarly stuff.
Disturbing stuff. Yeah.
I don't think at that age, actually. I think it was actually younger.
Younger, yeah. But it usually is younger.
Mostly like sci-fi kind of things. And like I remember being like 10 or so and drawing some fairly disturbing pictures of like bombs and guns killing people in Libya, because that was the thing at the time. Like Reagan was bombing Libya and we were all on board because Libya needed to be bombed because terrible Gaddafi, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because... The propaganda reaches all the way down, I guess.
It does, yeah.
But I think the phrase to have keyed in on in this case, I should have switched to a short sleeve shirt before we started recording here, is the my life is useless.
Yeah.
Like that's a warning phrase.
Yeah.
Now, generally, that's more of a warning about suicide than homicide, but still.
Yeah.
But again, the parents, like, they didn't even pull him out of school or anything. Now, but here's the question then that arises here is that, okay, probably his teachers spent more time with him than his parents did.
Yeah.
Why aren't they being held liable?
Yeah.
It seems that the principal didn't express with enough force that this was something serious to make the parents feel like they even needed to bring him out of school that day.
Yeah.
Or to do anything about it, I guess, later. Like, I'm a little confused on the timeline here. The mother did figure out that the gun was missing that day.
Yeah.
It may have been after the shooting already started. I'm not real sure about that, but
yeah.
Like, it does seem a little odd that at this point too, that they wouldn't, think, well, maybe we should look in this kid's backpack or something with all this going on. Well, I don't know. It's
So I'm pretty sure I read somewhere, and I may be getting my stuff confused, that they have like they search backpacks and stuff at that school, and that one of the security guards had joked about how heavy the backpack was.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah, that like when he was coming into school that day, like they had made the comments, oh, this is a heavy one here or something, but they didn't go through it.
Yeah.
So,
well, it seems that his parents were more concerned with their horses than they were with their kid.
Yeah.
From what I read, there seems to be like a level of neglect or just disinterest. With the mental health stuff and the potential dangers of this kid with a gun and so forth, that they just didn't take it any of this seriously.
Yeah.
And in some ways I get the impression, and maybe this is just me projecting from some people that I know, of parents being more interested in being the kid's friend than being the kid's parents.
Yeah.
But I don't know. At any rate, I am torn on this one. Like, it's weird to say that they're responsible, and like, how far my bigger concern is
how far does the responsibility reach?
Yeah,
because now once you start,
worried about the precedent that's been set.
Well, yeah, but once you start making somebody liable for somebody else's actions, like in any case, like those start to become funny lines and hard lines to draw.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't mean like comics.
What?
You don't mean like comics. You said funny lines.
Oh, yeah, no. The first thing I thought was like a comic book.
Like the funny pages kind of.
Yeah. No, like, I mean, where do you draw the line? Just like what you were saying with, well, shouldn't the teachers have some liability here? The principal, maybe the security guard? Like, I mean, once you go down that road of holding someone else responsible for somebody's actions, like, it's just a hard thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, are the parents responsible if the kid goes to somebody else's house and has too much to drink and has a car wreck on the way home and kills somebody?
Yeah. Well, and the car thing kind of comes into play here, too. Because if you have a young kid do something stupid in the car, like, we're going to hold the parents accountable for that?
Yeah.
I mean, they gave him the car.
Yeah.
You know?
They're supposed to be overseeing this to some degree.
Yeah. I mean, especially when they go a step further.
They didn't teach him to drive properly, obviously. You know?
I mean, they gave him the car, and then he stole their liquor. It was their liquor he was drinking.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's just anytime you're trying to hold somebody else responsible for somebody's actions, I think it's a dangerous road. Now, I'm, like I said, this one's tough because, like, I do have, on some level, believe that there is some kind of responsibility when you turn a kid loose with the gun like that. Even if you say it wasn't, like, in his room or whatever, but even still, like, there's a danger there. And there is a responsibility as a gun owner to you know, keep them put up responsibly.
Yeah, I'm actually more concerned here with the disregard for the mental health signs.
Yeah.
That it seems like a complete disregard for the kid's well-being, and that's the part that I think is the thing that makes them more liable.
The liable, yeah.
Yeah, in this case. I don't know. It's a hard question, but I am worried about the precedent that it sets. And this was a good case to pursue because there's so many reasons that you can find to blame the parents for what happened later.
Yeah.
With their kind of ignorance or disregard for the issues that he was having, for actually providing the weapon and not securing it in any way. There was a text from the mother that was some, like, the kid had gotten in trouble for something. I can't remember. Oh, he was looking at bullets online on his phone at school.
Yeah.
And the teachers contacted her about it, and when she contacted him, she was like, all right, well, just don't get caught doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe this is...
Yeah, maybe we're ignoring some signs here.
Yeah. So I think that that's the part of it that makes them more liable. And there's so many reasons that anybody, like even like hardcore libertarians like us, can find to say, it seems like they bear some responsibility here.
Yeah.
And so certainly some people that are more persuaded by those arguments to begin with are absolutely on board with this, I'm sure. Yeah. And both conservatives and liberals. And so this makes it a very easy case for them to use as a test case.
Yeah.
About whether they can do this kind of thing. And it's like middle class white family, so there's no accusation of any kind of ism.
Yeah.
But now the precedent is set. And the question is, like, to use a juror's, you know, judicial phrase, like, are future applications of this going to fall under the same kind of strict scrutiny that this did?
Yeah.
Or is this going to be used in the future as leverage against, you know, single parent households, poorer kids,
yeah,
et cetera, to try and, you know, scare them straight? Well, we're, you know, if you get involved in, gang stuff, then we're going to put your mama in jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of thing. I wonder about that. Now, I mentioned that to somebody a friend of mine, and he said, no, absolutely not. That would never be used that way because they want that poor violence.
Well, the argument to be made for that.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. Maybe that's not really the concern. But I do think that it's a strange precedent to set to hold somebody else responsible for the actions of a third party.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, like the question about whether the teachers should have some liability in this too, the answer to that is pretty easy. Well, the teachers don't have a legal responsibility for the child like the parents do.
Yeah.
So there's answers to some of this other stuff, but
yeah,
I don't know. To me, the other thing that I kept thinking about while I was, and it doesn't apply directly here, but is this idea that it seems like the government or the state wants to take more and more control over your kids anyway.
Yeah.
Well, they have to be in school from the time they're 4 until they're 16 or 5 or whatever, until they're 16. We get them 8 hours a day. You get them, you know, 4 to 6 other than sleeping time. And, and there's so many teachers out there that feel like they're responsible for these kids, that they want to parent these kids instead of the parents parenting the kids. Now, some of that is teachers, they don't want to parent the kids, but they feel like they have to because the parents aren't parenting the kids.
Yeah.
You know, there's that too. But it does seem like one of those situations, or it kept coming to mind, this idea that, like, okay, we're responsible for this until something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And then it's somebody else's responsibility.
Somebody else's, yeah.
I don't know I don't actually think that that's the case in this particular situation, but...
But it could be at some point.
Yeah.
If we follow down this road.
I don't know. This is just a strange thing to... Like, I don't know what the libertarian answer on this is.
No.
I mean, if you provide a weapon to somebody that has given you signs that they're ready to engage in some kind of violent attack, should you be held liable? Well, yeah, probably.
There's an argument for it, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you came to me one day and was just like, hey, I need to borrow one of your guns.
Yeah. Well, first off, that's never going to happen.
I know.
I have plenty of my own, I promise.
But that makes it even stranger, you see.
Fair enough.
You want somebody else's prints on that gun. Always have a second set of prints on a weapon.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
But you're my best friend, and I would still be like, well, what do you need it for?
Right. You'd ask some follow-up questions,
yeah,
I'm sure.
I mean, and if things didn't add up, I wouldn't give you the gun.
Yeah, right.
So if I just gave you the gun without asking any questions, and you went and like robbed the local liquor store with it or something, should I be held liable for that? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I enabled this.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I didn't do any kind of due diligence to try and prevent it.
Dissuade me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if I didn't know exactly what you were going to do, like, it's a strange request and...
Yeah, just be handing out guns to folks.
Yeah, like. And like, for how long? Well, I only need it for an hour or so. Like, what are you going to do? I mean, like, this is a strange situation. So, really got to get that TB fixed, man.
I know it.
I don't think that it's unreasonable to hold them liable.
Yeah.
For this. I think that they contributed to the violence. It's just weird to say they contributed to the violence through inaction, but there was a lot of reason for action.
Yeah.
That they didn't take.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a hard call, though.
Yeah. I mean, it's a scary road to go down.
Yeah.
Like I say.
I don't like that the precedent's been set, and I hope that anytime this is applied in the future, that it will be this kind of just like really out there kind of case that
has to meet some kind of pretty strict criteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My concern is that that's just not how the judicial system works in this country.
It's definitely not how it works. So
we got some attorneys that listen to this. Like, I would really love to hear your commentary on this.
Yeah.
So contact me, call me, send me an email, something. I'm really interested what particularly a criminal attorney would think about this situation. Like I would like to have the insight. I actually probably should have called some people.
Yeah.
Now that I'm thinking about this, I should have made some phone
definitely
calls,
have some contacts on that. Yeah. So maybe for next week.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on from that. Cause this next thing is going to take longer.
Yeah. a little bit more to dive into on this one.
Sorry, I need to take a drink, and Liberty Larry can't fill gaps.
No, not really good at that.
So the next thing, we talked about the Missouri versus Biden case a while back. This is the case about social media censorship from the administration, from the executive branch.
Yeah.
And the accusation is that it's a violation of the First Amendment. And there were two courts that upheld that idea. The appeals court, Fifth Circuit, I think, appeals court rolled back some of the injunction that had been placed by the first court. But even they said, like, there's good reason to believe that a line was crossed.
Yeah.
And they upheld a portion of the injunction also. Well, now this has gone up to the Supreme Court. Right. So, of course, the first question is whether anybody involved had standing. I don't really understand all that, so I'm going to skip it.
Yeah.
But the...
I'm assuming they decided they did.
Yeah, at least so far.
Yeah.
Enough to keep going.
Okay.
Because they were like, it's two states and five individuals, but the truth is if any one of them has standing, then the court needs to address it.
Yeah.
So they kind of moved on from there.
Yeah.
Now, the defense of the state's power to censor here, their argument is essentially it was a polite request.
Yeah.
And the social media companies can do with it what they will.
Yeah. The problem is the mafia uses polite request.
Right. And that's how the lower courts addressed it, too, is that it seems like it would be a shame if anything were to happen to, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
The Supreme Court, I don't know. I'm actually kind of pessimistic about how this is going to turn out, but I'll talk more about that later.
All right.
Let's set the base here. So yeah, their position is essentially that these were just requests or encouragement, and that the social media companies often denied them, and so it wasn't coercive in any way, and, so it's not a First Amendment issue at all.
Yeah.
Or it's not a violation of the First Amendment. At all. And the government is entitled to express its opinions about information that's out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, any media company can do with that what they will.
Yeah.
So.
Man, am I the only one that has a problem with the government even, like, having those type of opinions?
You're not I don't have a problem with them having those opinions. Yeah.
I don't feel like that's really the place of the government.
No, okay, so then let me take the other side then. So the First Amendment defense is that essentially that it has an impact on their actions just by the power of the government.
Yeah.
That it was coercive, that there is talk of Section 230, which, of course, is something that has come up in hearings and so forth many times. Like, well, maybe we need to reevaluate your protections under Section 230, which says that a platform like these social media companies that's content is user-created, they're not liable for anything that the users create.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then the question became, well, like, maybe we're not treating them just as a platform like this. Maybe we should hold them liable for information that's posted by the users. Well, that certainly has a big impact on how much they censor.
Yeah.
So there's also like big government contracts involved in this too. And so very early on, Neil Gorsuch, Justice Gorsuch, who I will tell you that from my listening, I listened to the whole oral arguments. This is almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
That guy is the best.
Yeah.
At least on this case, like he.
I mean, that was the assumption when he was put in. Like he's the argument was he was a pretty libertarian judge.
Yeah. Well, he's a what do they call it? A textualist or whatever.
Oh, textualist. Right? Yeah. Constitutionalist. Something along those lines.
Yeah. So
original interpretation.
Yeah. I'm gonna play a clip from him, but he very early on in the arguments is talking about the way that the government is interacting with these companies and that they're talking about regular meetings and that it's, you know, that we're a partnership and we're on the same side and, you know, the threat of changing how Section 230 applies to them and demands. So there's like this carrot and the stick kind of thing too. That this just seems different from how they would interact with other kinds of media companies. And let's just go ahead and play his clip.
All right.
Wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service?
Okay, so make your comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the difference is with all of those publications that he named, they already have control over those. Through years of, I'm sure, the same stuff they're doing to the social media companies now.
Well, and it might be, but there were a few comments on just how demanding and rude and so forth some of these interactions were. Saying, you know, we like to see these. Oh, and Matt Taibbi talked about this too with Twitter.
Yeah.
That, you know, we'd like to see these accounts be banned or whatever. And then like a day later, why has no action been taken on this yet? And that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of unusual in these kinds of media relationships. And I'll just let Glenn Greenwald in an interview with Matt Taibbi, interviewing Matt Taibbi, I should say, comment on this because, you know, he's got the inside knowledge and I think that he could probably express this better than I can.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, talking earlier and I know you've had this experience too, but like when the government tries to convince you not to publish something, but they know it's ultimately your decision. They're very polite. You know, they're trying their best to convince you, to persuade you, to give you information, to negotiate with you. Like, hey, maybe if you're going to publish this, you could withhold this. That was the experience I had throughout the entire Snowden reporting and other area instances when I've had classified documents and we've negotiated with the government. Or not even negotiated, but just gave the government an opportunity to, look, persuade us. And usually they don't persuade us, but the way they behave themselves is very, very deferential because the power is in our hands because they know the ultimate decision rests with us.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, no.
I mean, we need something from you. We're not going to be mean.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Well, they know they don't have the leverage there, mm-hmm. but they know with the social media companies that they do have the leverage.
Right.
Just because of the...
With those bludgeons that Gorsuch talked about with the Section 230 stuff, with exactly. the antitrust stuff.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference. There's a whole bunch of clips back to back to back here, I know, but...
we need to prove a point.
Yeah, well, and I think it's better to use their own arguments.
Yeah.
So when the defender of the First Amendment got up there, I thought this was kind of... This isn't all of it, and I'll address some other things too, but this is kind of, to me, the core of the argument for defending the First Amendment here.
Yeah.
So, Your Honor, I guess this goes to the bully pulpit as well, as I understand that the bully pulpit has never been used to target the object of suppressing a third-party speech. You can use it to coerce behavior. You can use it to coerce companies to take certain actions. But when the government is identifying a specific viewpoint and specific content that it wishes to wholly eliminate from public discourse, that's, I think, when the First Amendment problem arises.
And I feel like I should add for content's sake, here, or context sake, I guess, that this suit arose from censorship around the COVID regime.
Yeah.
That this was about, like, you know, Jay Bhattacharya and other professional medical doctors whose information or opinions or research was being suppressed on the social media platforms at the behest of the U.S. government because it was counter to their goals, I guess.
Yeah.
And a lot of this information turned out to be correct. That the, you know, some of the early ideas about how, about the infection mortality rates or infection fatality rates, depending on, you know, which, phrasing you're using, whatever. I guess IFR is the most common thing. So infection fatality rates were much lower than what they were saying originally. And so the government saying, or some of the early projections were saying it was like 3%, and then it turned out to be more like 0.015 or something like that. And people were getting kicked off for those kinds of, that kind of information. That it turned out to actually be much more infectious, though. So the people essentially eliminating the possibility that masks and lockdowns were actually going to affect the spread.
Yeah.
But that kind of information was being suppressed. But that was all, turns out, to have been factual information,
yeah.
like actually correct, and yeah. it was being suppressed. The other thing that what... I would like to have heard him say, and he did kind of hint at this, but he didn't say it outright. And I think it's important to say it outright, is that any government quote encouragement end quote is inherently coercive because of the power that rests in government.
Yeah.
Because of the power that the government wields, any encouragement that they give towards these kind of companies about what to do is inherently coercive.
Absolutely. Yeah, because the government's the one thing that can end your business in a day.
Yes.
Like, there's very few other things that can end it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And the government's one of them. It's the biggest one for sure. Ask anybody that's owned a small business. They'll tell you real quick.
Yeah.
Stay out of their way.
And you know, there's a lot to be gained by getting in line with the government. Like, they have the carrot and the stick. They got that stick, those big, you know, the Section 230 and the antitrust stuff, but they've also got big contracts that they give out to these companies as well.
There's
a lot of money for them as well.
Yep.
Besides the fact that any of these decisions can affect their revenue, can affect their profit, and their profit matters to them.
Oh yeah.
And the truth is that in a publicly traded company, there's a fiduciary responsibility for the board to do what's best for the company's bottom line.
Yeah. 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 If that means going along with the government, that's just what it means.
Yeah.
So,
something, by the way, that we should point out about TikTok after the discussion last week.
Yeah.
TikTok's a capitalist business as well. Like,
yeah.
They have already, you know, they've already censored information in the U.S. because it's good for their business in the U.S.
Yeah.
They don't want to get closed down in the United States. They're already getting in line, which is just more information or more evidence, I suppose, that it's not about, you know, the Chinese getting your data or that any kind of concern about what kind of information that they're pushing out to people. They already censored themselves at the behest of the U.S. government to because there's money here.
Absolutely.
And so it's something something else that we speculated on last week. So go listen to that one.
Yeah.
But I am concerned about this. I don't think this is going to go in favor of First Amendment. I think this is going to go in favor of the government of state censorship.
You're not optimistic.
I'm not optimistic. And let me explain why. So the wisdom here would be, well, there's six conservative justices on the Supreme Court. So surely they're going to defend the, you know, rights of free speech, because somehow free speech has become a right-wing thing where it has not traditionally been, by the way.
Yeah.
The left wing used to control the free speech movement.
Yeah. And that's the reason once upon a time everybody called me a left winger. Like, yeah. I remember those days.
Yeah.
They're not that long ago.
No, exactly. So my concern here, though, is that you know, like I said, traditional wisdom would say that you only need two conservative justices to defect over to the state on this for the state to win.
Yeah.
There's three of them that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
Roberts is often
a sellout.
Yeah. he often changes sides, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, the truth is that hopefully none of these justices really have sides in that way.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be a partisan thing, but whatever.
But
I guess it's kind of become one no matter what. Yeah. I think that there's an integrity in the justices that it's not really a partisan thing.
Yeah.
But there is certainly a political outlook, like an idea of what all these things mean that seems to fall on either the conservative or the liberal side.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess you can't fight that anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, Roberts is a potential defector. Kavanaugh almost certainly will defect.
Yeah.
And the reason that Kavanaugh will defect is because he's a big believer in the security state. He really thinks that, you know,
the government has a responsibility to protect people.
Yeah. Well, more than that, actually, that's more Coney Barrett's position, which is
really?
Why I'm worried about her.
Yeah.
But Kavanaugh's is more like that the government has a duty to maintain secrets.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah.
That there's information that could... The thing that he said twice in, like, to both of the attorneys... I mean, he said once to each attorney. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Twice in the thing was like, what if this threatens the war effort?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh God, this guy.
Yeah.
Thanks, Trump.
He's not one of us. Yeah.
No. And Coney Barrett just falls down on that. Well, the government has some responsibility to protect people.
Yeah.
And what if there's bad information out there that's harming people? Like, maybe the government does have responsibility. Now, I'm hoping, because she seemed far more critical of the pro First Amendment side, that she's just that she's using that to try and sharpen her own arguments come down on the First Amendment side.
Yeah.
But I don't know, and I'm really uncertain.
Yeah.
Now, Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan, definitely coming down on the state side.
Yeah.
Sotomayor is a wild card.
Yeah.
Sotomayor has been good on censorship issues in the past.
Yeah.
She's not generally in favor of government censoring public speech.
Yeah.
I actually think that she's going to come down on the First Amendment side.
Nice.
Which would mean that all three of the conservative justices that I have concerns over need to defect. Alito, Gorsuch, Thomas.
Yeah.
Thomas I'm not 100% on, but I feel pretty solid about. Alito and Gorsuch are definitely on the First Amendment side.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but this, it is a question. It's going to, it could go either way. And I do have legitimate concerns that it'll come down, that they'll make a decision in favor of the state. Now, we won't know for a couple of months.
Yeah. Unless it gets leaked.
Well, yeah. I don't think that'll happen again.
Yeah. The fact that you say again.
Well, I know, but that was a particularly hot political issue, and this one just isn't.
Was going to say, I mean, all of what we've talked about today has been news to me. Like, it's not on the mainstream that I've seen.
Yeah. Now, let me play a clip from Ketanji Brown Jackson. That this is the kind of thinking that's prevalent on the left, I would say, but that really concerns me. So let me go ahead and play one more clip. This is the last one.
All right, for today.
But here we go.
Biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. I mean, what would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, kids, this is not safe, don't do it, is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information.
She said duty.
Several times. Okay, I probably should have said before, and if you have to go back and listen to the clip again, I'm sorry, but her hypothetical was, what if there's a challenge that's on one of these social media platforms that's going around for kids to jump out of higher and higher windows?
Oh, kind of like when we had the Tide Pod challenge?
Yeah. And that, you know, kids are getting hurt or even killed from jumping out of windows that are too high. And doesn't the government have a responsibility to...
Man, you don't want to know that, my answer to that.
No, I do. What's your answer to that?
My answer to that is, man, like, we're thinning the herd as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if your kid's dumb enough to take that challenge, I'm just saying, man.
There's a case for that there too, isn't there? But now the pro First Amendment attorney, his position was that the government has other actions that they can take. Primarily, they can say,
don't jump out of windows.
This is the correct information. This is true information. This is the government line that this is a dangerous thing and can be really hazardous to your health. And I want you to magnify that position. So what he keeps saying over and over again is that rather than taking other people's speech down, the government can project its own.
Yeah. Well, that's fair. But here's the problem with that. And this is the thing that none of them will admit, is that people don't listen to the stuff that the government says because the government is full of crap, like 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And everybody knows they're full of crap. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like if the government tells you not to do it, you're like, oh, well, it might be a good idea.
Yeah. Why don't they want me jumping out of windows?
Yeah, exactly.
Some kind of conspiracy.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
So, but that's the government's fault for ruining its own credibility.
That's true.
Like, they bear the responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and it doesn't just have to be government. I mean, I would like to think that if that kind of challenge was going around, that there would be a lot of people up there, you know.
Yeah.
Saying, maybe construction workers saying, I fell off a ladder that high and I now have a broken back.
That's, yeah, it's not a good idea. It's not a good day.
But the answer to her question, it's actually the first part of that clip that really disturbs me, where she's like, it seems that your position is that the First Amendment hamstrings the government in the most important times. Yes, that's exactly what it was written to do.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the purpose of the First Amendment.
That was the intent that the founders had.
Yeah, is to hamstring the government. Yeah. It's government shall make no law.
Yeah, yeah. Enough said. End it right there.
Yeah.
That's the society I want to live in.
Well, I don't know about that.
I'm just saying.
I like... I, I think rules are important.
Rules or laws? Because I have a distinction.
there is a distinction there, but the rules that I think really should be rules may as well be laws.
Okay, fair enough. kind of like gravity.
No, not like gravity at all.
Not like gravity at all.
That's a different podcast.
Fair enough.
Here's the real concern. Like, the most dangerous lies out there in public are the official ones.
Yeah.
Are the state-sponsored lies.
Yeah.
The lies that get us into wars. Yep. The lies that, you know.
Lock you in your home.
Exactly. So the official lies are the most dangerous lies anyway. It's not the public speech that needs to be censored. The government's speech is far more dangerous than any challenge going around or anything that any individual is saying out there.
Yeah.
So there was a New York Times article that was published, I think, Sunday, right before these oral arguments that were Monday.
Yeah.
And it was full of what they would call misinformation, I think.
Yeah.
I read this article. There was a lot of nothing in it, first off, but the way they characterized this case was really strange. They suggested that the case, this First Amendment question, it's really about the pro First Amendment people, those crazy right wingers, essentially, are just trying to stop government's ability to fight right wing extremism online. And to prevent them from or to allow these crazy right wingers to continue to propagate election lies. And so they didn't even say that the case was actually about free speech issues that came up during the COVID regime.
Right.
And so they presented it in this light of that it's important to limit free speech online. Because otherwise, Donald Trump might get elected again. That's essentially how the New York Times was framing it to their readership.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to me how these kinds of issues are no longer about any kind of principle or belief in freedom or independence that you would have traditionally associated with the left.
Yeah.
And that all of these things are being couched in the idea of, well, about Trump.
Can't let the other guy win.
Well,
and when this time it's specifically Trump.
It's specifically about Trump. Well, this has never really come up before in this way.
Yeah.
And I think that it is specific to Trump because they've made Trump into such a
Trump is dangerous, a unique evil. Like,
right.
That's the argument.
Well, it is. And they've convinced enough people that they can get people that I think historically would have been like, no, wait a minute. You can't limit what people say in the public forum. You can't limit political speech. You can't limit this kind. This is a thing that is protected. It's important. This is a civil rights issue that's very important.
Absolutely.
But if you can couch it into the position of, well, this could permit Trump, that's enough. That they have successfully propagandized people about this guy to such a degree.
They think they have. I'm skeptical if your average, even like non-Trump supporter, like will buy into that type of argument. But I don't know that. Like I say.
Well, I mean, I don't know a lot of the people that this would apply to, but I can tell you in that interview that Glenn Greenwald and. Of Matt Taibbi.
Yeah.
They do know some of those people.
And they feel like they're susceptible.
Yeah.
I mean, and they may be right. Like, because just like you were saying, like, I just don't know that many people that, I mean, I know some, but not enough.
And it's beyond the they think they may be susceptible. It's that they've gotten in arguments with people that would have been good on this years ago, but now. Trump.
Yeah. The unique evil has arrived.
It is important for a free society to have freedom of speech. The way to to stamp out misinformation, disinformation, or whatever, is to allow it to
be out there.
Yeah, to be out there. To let people say it and let people argue against it.
Yeah. Because the marketplace of ideas will push the bad out. It just will.
I was looking for this. It's not exactly what I had in mind. I got a Alexander Solzhenitsyn quote on this. This is the guy that wrote The Gulag Archipelago, which is a tough read, but I recommend to people because you just have no idea.
Yeah.
But he said, the prolonged absence of any free exchange of information within a country opens up a gulf of incomprehension between whole groups of the population, between millions and millions.
Yeah.
And he's speaking from experience on that. We don't want to become a country where the government feels that it has a duty or even has the capability of limiting people's speech in the public sphere about anything.
Yeah, because and the most dangerous part about that, at least in my eyes, is anytime you start banning speech or pushing it underground, it almost always turns violent. Once people realize that they don't have a voice or they can't express their opinions, they start expressing them in violence.
Yeah, that's true too.
That's we don't want that. Like we've got enough of that.
If you don't give them a peaceful outlet, they'll find a violent one.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So, that's not exactly the kind of thing I want to end on, but we need to wrap up.
We do need to wrap up.
So, yeah.
I don't know. I heard there's a bloodbath coming.
Oh, gosh. Do you want to end on that? We just laugh about that. The thing that I'm amazed... All right. So, it seems pretty clear in context that Trump was talking about that there would be a bloodbath for the auto industry.
Yeah. Because he wants to put a 100% tariff on cars that China's building in Mexico and wanting to send to the US.
Yeah. Well, the ironic thing about that, or paradoxical, I guess, is that because of the trade deal that he created,
is the reason they're doing that.
Between Mexico and Canada and the US, he can't. I'm pretty sure.
Really?
I don't think there's any way. China found a loophole.
Well, I was going to say, this was a workaround that China came up with, right?
Yeah, essentially, if it's produced in Mexico, I'm pretty sure it can cross the border under this trade agreement that Trump signed.
Yeah.
I don't think that he can make an exception or a carve out. It's too late.
Yeah.
It's just not part of the agreement.
Yeah.
So that's the really funny, but even worse than that though, is that I've heard since then, it was pretty quickly exposed that the media was being ridiculous about this.
Oh yes.
Pulling that phrase out of context.
Oh, and I heard it all over mainstream media. And I was like screaming at the TV every time. I'm like, dude, like that is just underhanded.
Yeah. Well, the craziest thing to me though, is that I heard on, No Agenda's show that came out yesterday, that they've doubled down on this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're not going to give up on
it. Well, it seems like he's talking about the auto industry, but we don't know, and we know how he thinks, and obviously this is still another dog whistle, blah, blah, blah. It's unreal.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and it's just a sign of... See, we were going to laugh about something. Now I'm going to talk about something serious real quick before we finish. It's just a sign of that that we are incapable of discussing issues, actually, in political discourse anymore.
Yeah.
We don't talk about what people have done and what they're going to do and, well, in terms of how they're going to govern.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, I mean, it's just...
It amazes me that they tried to pull this because, like, we did have 4 years of Trump. Like, we know how Trump is going to govern. Like, I mean, you know.
Well, not this time.
Oh, this time. You know, oh, yeah.
I know.
Well,
I know.
that was the ploy before last time. Well, when he's in his last term, he'll really, like, bust it open.
Well, the one that really gets me is we told you that he wasn't going to give up power. And see?
Yeah. Yeah.
January 6th. No, but he left office in January.
Yeah.
Of 20, like he didn't
Yeah,
he didn't bunker down or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't understand. Like, the point that you're trying to make is contradicted by your own example.
And all I'm saying is, like, everybody go out and look into all of this on your own. But, dude, I'm just saying January 6th was an inside job. I'm sorry.
Well, like, I don't know if it's an inside job, but it certainly isn't what it's been created into.
I don't know, man. The FBI,
it wasn't as serious.
And when I say inside job, I mean the FBI had people on the ground.
Well, sure.
And were facilitating this.
And there was obviously security people letting people in, and you know, there was a lot of that.
There's
going on
a lot of information out there that says that this wasn't Trump trying to cause something. That this was, you know, this was something else entirely.
Yeah. So, well, it's a good excuse to turn all of the apparatus that had been built to fight terror worldwide inward.
Yep. Absolutely.
And hopefully they don't get another break here and have the Supreme Court fall on the side of the state.
Yeah, because that's another link in the chain.
Yep. All right. How was that a happy ending? Dang it.
Better?
Okay, it's an improvement.
Yeah, there was a hopefully
in that last sentence, so we'll go with that. All right. Well, we've gone on long enough, and what the clips is going to be. Anyway, so we'll be back next week. Yeah.
See no reason why not.
I don't see any reason either. I see no reason anywhere. So yeah, we'll be back next week, and you can follow us on Facebook and subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, and or Podbean. Like and share, comment, subscribe. You can leave reviews. That helps. Well, positive reviews helps. Yeah. If you got negative reviews, you can email me at michael@thelibertymike.
Yeah, there you go.
It's michael@thelibertymike.com. And if you just if you have anything to say about this, email me anytime. I love to see them. And I try to respond to them.
Yep.
Mostly successfully.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be back next week when we finally get this right. And in the meantime, try to stay free.
Life's short, live free.
Ciao.
Later.